Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
One more economic indicator, hot-handed shoppers. Shoplifters of the world. Among the woes of beleaguered retailers this year is an increase in first-time shoplifting. When the cash flow goes south and morality follows,
hand it over
on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 23rd. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
This hour, thoughts from an outgoing moderate Republican congressman. Russia, Venezuela, and Iran are among a group of countries that are going to be meeting about gas resources. And last-minute regulations that the Bush administration is adopting are controversial. We'll take a look at one. All that and more, but first, these headlines.
Holiday travelers are finding their flights frozen stiff this morning. Nasty winter weather is wrecking plans from coast to coast. Chicago will get snow and sub-zero wind chill. Chicago resident Ken Dzinski hopes to make it to Arizona.
In Phoenix right now, it's 65, and the pool temperature is a constant 81.5 degrees.
Well, he's lucky if he gets there. Not the case for Phoenix resident Tasha Wallace. She's trapped in the cold Chicago air.
It hurts. Like, when you breathe real deep, it makes my lungs hurt real bad.
Sorry, Tasha. The Northwest is hurting, too. There's snow on the ground in Seattle, something meteorologist Chris Burke doesn't see very often.
There are many winters where Seattle doesn't get any snow at all. To have a week of snow is very unusual.
Airports are affected in the Northwest, and even budget travelers are stuck. Greyhound says no service in or out of Seattle or Portland, Oregon, until icy roads get safer.
Today we're watching for market-moving economic data that's due out this morning. New GDP numbers hit later this hour. Consumer sentiment and housing numbers follow later. The Minnesota Senate race recount is wrapping up, but a final result is still out of reach. Democrat Al Franken has a slim lead over Republican incumbent Norm Coleman, but legal battles loom over rejected absentee ballots and Coleman's claim that some votes were counted twice.
That race is going to go on forever. They'll be counting the votes forever. Speaking of Senate seats, don't forget about the vacancy in Illinois. We're watching for new information today about Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Today, President-elect Barack Obama's transition team is set to release a report on its contacts with the embattled governor's office. Cynics among us will point out that it sure is interesting that Team Obama would release a controversial report today. After all, it's just ahead of a holiday when many Americans won't be paying that much attention to the news. The transition team says the report's been ready for a week, but they held it at the request of U.S. attorneys investigating Blagojevich. The Dow dropped yesterday just shy of 1%. It closed at 85.19. The S&P lost nearly 2%. It begins trading on this last full day of trading before Christmas at 8:71. So you got a holiday tune in your brain?
I got lots of them.
Can you
and
get
I think some
of
our listeners got lots of them. Some of them they like and some of them they don't like so much.
Hey, this is Rook from Woodbury, Connecticut, home of Leroy Anderson. And my favorite holiday earworm is Sleigh Ride, which, by the way, Fox Sports stole for their NFL football. Ba-da-bum, 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 bum, bum.
877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In this holiday transition moment, we are all awaiting the beginning of the Barack Obama administration, inauguration, of course, on January 20th. It's a hello for a whole new set of leaders in the White House and many in Congress. But among the faces who won't be in the incoming Congress is Chris Shays, who's leaving office as Connecticut's 4th District Representative. He's represented the people of that district for over 21 years. And if there is a personal narrative to the national political narrative of how difficult it was to be a Republican in 2008, do you remember the election? Especially a moderate Republican, it is Chris Shays' story. And he joins us from Fairfield, Connecticut. Congressman Shays, thanks so much for being a part of the program.
Nice to be on your program.
You know, there are sort of two questions I have for you. One is just what is the future of the principled stand in your party? You voted with the president on a number of very crucial votes and stood up for President Bush, yet it didn't seem to help you in 2008. What is the future of taking that principled stand and being a Republican?
Well, the thing that surprises me is I voted with him only 50% of the time, so there were 50% of the time I didn't vote with him, and that didn't seem to matter either. The job of a member of Congress is to listen, learn, help, and lead. We do casework up in the district, and we do write legislation down in Washington. And so that's what we do, and doing something just to be reelected, there's no point in our being there. So taking principled stands is something that we should just do and gladly so. Now, if you ask me, are there things that I did that might have changed the course of the election over the past few years that didn't relate as much to principle, maybe I could sort that out, but...
Well, did the Republicans leave you, or did you leave this sort of Republican core that was unsuccessful against Barack Obama but might have helped you in your district?
Well, you know, I think the biggest problem was George Bush, and it really doesn't relate as much to moderate or conservative. He was just intensely disliked in the 4th Congressional District. He had a favorable rating of 24%, an unfavorable rating of 75%. But you also have to add in the 4th Congressional District, we were impacted by the financial meltdown more than any other district. Darien, Connecticut, the town I was raised in, had the largest unemployment. I think tens of thousands of my constituents lost their jobs or had to take huge pay cuts. Definitely weren't going to get bonuses. And while they may not have blamed me, their spouses might have. And I don't mean their spouses being wives. In some cases, it could be the husbands of wives who said that their wives lost their jobs.
But now as you take a look at where the Republican Party is and the moderates that, like yourself, who lost the election, what need do you think the GOP needs to do in 2009 to turn the tide?
Well, let me just say, I really was disappointed I lost, in part because I felt I was at the top of my game. And I don't mean it's a game, but I felt that I was ready to be head of the Government Oversight Committee. I felt pretty certain that I could be a leading spokesman for the Republican Party, being one of the few in the Northeast. Very disappointed I lost. Now, your question is, what is going to be the role of the moderates and what does the Republican Party have to do? It will be a regional party if it doesn't welcome moderates, because moderates would reflect the kind of district that you have in the Northeast. A very conservative, particularly socially conservative person in the Northeast is not going to get elected. So what the Republican Party needs to, instead of hide moderates, it needs to showcase them. It needs to have people understand that we are a moderate to conservative party, not a liberal party, but a moderate to conservative party.
But, Congressman, you know, what is really confusing to me, and I've spent a certain amount of time driving through Connecticut, but I don't certainly know it as well as you do. How come a Joe Lieberman can change parties and can project himself? I mean, it's different because he's a Democrat, or I don't know what he is now. But he can have this sort of affiliation with the conservative movement in the United States and not pay the penalty that you have paid.
Well, first off, his record is moderate to liberal. He votes with the Democrats about 85% of the time. And on a few key issues, he was sympathetic to the president. And so on the war in Iraq, he voted for the surge. I voted for the surge. He believed in the surge. I believed in the surge. And that would, in some cases, define who we are in spite of every other vote that we might take.
What are you going to miss about Congress?
Oh, I miss a lot of things. I tell people that being a member of Congress is like going to the largest university, being told you have to take every course and get a passing grade. So we tend to know a little about everything, and we're taught by our constituents. And what I was beginning to feel that I was really connecting with my constituents. They weren't calling me Congressman. They were calling me Chris. If I'd go to a fancy event, the folks who were doing the serving would come up, shake my hand, and tell me something was on their mind. And I really felt like I had reached this point where I had a really great rapport with my constituents. I love the policy battles that we had. I like the fact that I'll miss the fact that I think Senator Obama, now President-elect Obama, has a huge opportunity. I would have loved to have helped him navigate through a very partisan Congress. I'll miss my friends on both sides of the aisle. I'll miss the daily activity I had with my constituents. I have no regrets. I have disappointments, but I had the best constituents in the country. Some of the best educated, and some who had huge needs that I loved addressing.
And you won't have the opportunity to address them. And I just hear in your voice this sense of heartbreak about not being there at a time of such crisis for particularly the people in your district who are so harmed by the financial crisis.
Are you
collateral damage of George Bush, or is it something that you did that caused this?
It's a combination. Being for the war in Iraq, being wrong about finding weapons of mass destruction and recognizing that I was wrong, that's difficult. I tell people there were about five major votes in the course of legacy votes. And the one legacy vote I got wrong was believing that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction and would use them. That was a reality, but I didn't lose because of that. There are issues. I mean, I can remember at the beginning of the session, my staff said, when the president gives his State of the Union address tonight, don't be on the aisle. I said, why? They said, because you'll have to shake his hand. And I'm a stubborn kind of guy. I thought, well, that's a dumb reason. And I immediately went to the floor of the House, and I took my some books, and I put them on the seat and right on the aisle and put my name on and reserved the seat. And when he was coming down the aisle, I saw him standing ready to enter, and he looked kind of nervous and uneasy. And I thought, this guy, right or wrong, has given the best of his time to this country, 8 years, and I'm going to do something to pick up his spirit. So as he walked by, I said, Mr. President, this is going to be a great night tonight, and thanks for your service to our country.
And that was exactly what your staff advised you not to do.
Well, he walked by me and then came back and whispered something in my ear, and I gave him a kiss on the cheek. And I thought, oh, my God, now what is my staff going to think? And that became symbolic of somehow something that my constituents didn't want to see, and basically an act of kindness to the president. I made an assumption that I think was maybe wrong, that the kindness should be respected, and my votes for or against the president should be respected. And I only supported the president half the time. In fact, in the last few years, Hillary Clinton voted with the president more than I did.
Yeah, but it's so much about images, as we learned to our peril in politics and in media in the 2008. Chris Shays, thanks so much for joining us. Congressman Chris Shays is a Republican U.S. representative from Connecticut's 4th District, a seat he was voted out of in the 2008 elections.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In the spirit of the holidays, we're trying to go deep into your brain and find those holiday song memories that just won't and can't escape.
Dr. Carol from Red Bank, New Jersey. My prescription for earworms, which are those annoying songs that you hear in your head, is to listen to two things that you love. It can be anything, Messiah, Chanticleer, not even Christmas music, and repeat as needed, and then call me in the morning. Thanks.
Ah, thank goodness the doctor is in the house. Any holiday songs you can't get out of your brain, handles, Messiah included, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Today, President-elect Obama's transition team is expected to release a report, an internal report, that clears incoming White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel of any wrongdoing in his contact with disgraced Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Meanwhile, the Illinois State Senate Committee is considering impeachment of the governor. The committee has ended its work, at least for this week, without any conclusions. Joining us for more is Ben Smith, a senior political writer for Politico.com. Welcome back. Always a pleasure to have you, Ben.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about this report. First of all, why are they talking about releasing it now when last week they were saying that they were withholding it because of a request from the U.S. attorney who was continuing to investigate Blagojevich?
His request had been they hold off a week, supposedly. I mean, Obama said last week he'd release it in a week, and, you know, that's today's the day. So I think it's unclear what loose ends the U.S. attorney wanted to tie up, you know, if there were kind of wiretaps that people were unaware of that they were still using or what. Today's the day, evidently.
And so do you have a sense of what's going to be in the report? There's certainly been some articles suggesting how Rahm Emanuel might be cleared.
Yeah, what the Obama camp is kind of leaking out. And, I mean, you know, we should keep in mind this is in a report prepared internally by the Obama folks, which they say but have not even showed, you know, clears them. So, you know, you got to take it with a certain amount of distance. But, you know, what they say is that they found that, you know, Emanuel had spoken once to Blagojevich and basically had a pretty, you know, uninteresting conversation. There was no haggling over you know, details of a cash offer for the Senate seat or anything like that. And that he'd spoken several times to Blagojevich's chief of staff, who was also indicted. But that, again, that, you know, that essentially, you know, the chief of staff had at one point said, you know, so we're not all we're getting for appointing your person to the Senate is appreciation. And Rahm had said, yes, that's it. So, I mean, you know, if that's all there is, there's not much there.
Well, if anything, it actually helps the Obama transition team, and specifically Rahm Emanuel, if he clearly says, we're not giving you anything in return for picking a candidate we'd like to see take Barack Obama's Senate seat.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the criminal complaint in the first place had was Blagojevich complaining that he wasn't getting any kind of bribes from the Obama people.
Ben, is it possible, though, that appreciation is actually a code name for a series of strip malls in suburban Chicago?
You know, I wouldn't. This is Illinois politics. You never know.
You never know. But let me ask you this, because obviously the Blagojevich investigation, the scandal surrounding his administration continues. At this point, is there a sense that President-elect Obama is going to escape from this unscathed?
Well, I mean, you know, there's just been absolutely no suggestion that he did anything wrong other than basically, you know, coexist with this guy for years and endorse him in 06 when everybody kind of knew that this stuff was starting to come. But this isn't news. I mean, nobody really – he had always been, you know, kind of a neutral, you know, among these – he was never – really engaged with the corrupt Chicago politicians, but at the same time, he didn't make a career out of trying to shut them down. But this was, you know, that's not news. That was something that was certainly talked about and was clear during the campaign. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you know, he can basically move on. Although I think, like, you know, this will be something that people who want to find conspiracies and want to find reasons to go after Obama can dig into forever.
So what's the sense of who's actually going to get his seat? Because come January 20th, he will be inaugurated as our 44th president, and his Senate seat will be vacated.
Well, you know, they're still arguing about whether it's going to be an appointment or a special election. The Democrats initially said, oh, well, the only sort of, you know, kind of pure way to do it is to have a special election. And then they said, wait a second, a Republican could win. And they're now sort of trying to walk that back. But, you know, it's a funny thing because Blagojevich is still the governor, and he could still, you know, he could appoint anybody. He could appoint himself. And, you know, he seems like he's a guy who could do anything right now.
But his lawyer, Ed Jensen, explicitly said that the governor had no intention of appointing anyone.
Right. The lawyer did say that, but that could change. I mean, because as the governor said, he thinks he's totally innocent and will be vindicated.
Right.
So who knows? This could drag on for a long time. As you said, the impeachment committee does not seem like it's going to act particularly fast.
So we'll wait and see, essentially.
Yeah, but you know, there's a number of Illinois politicians, Congress people like Jesse Jackson Jr., Jan Schakowsky, would love the seat but can't take it from Blagojevich. You know, there's a little concern that an appointment at this point will sort of be a poison chalice, that whoever run against will basically say, you know, here's the person who took this appointment from the corrupt Democrats, and make it very hard for you to get reelected.
Right. Well, thanks for that update, Ben. One quick last question. You got a holiday song that just makes you nuts?
You know, the one stuck in my head, oddly enough, is Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages, let our song praise your saving power.
Ben Smith, senior political writer for Politico.com, thanks for the update on Illinois and thanks for the holiday song. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got a few headlines for us.
And the time is 29 minutes past the hour. Just keeping a lookout for you for a key economic number that comes out in a few minutes. We'll hear the latest GDP numbers. Analysts are expecting them to be dreary. Housing and consumer sentiment data follow later this morning. In Minnesota, Democrat Al Franken has a slim lead over Republican Senator Norm Coleman. But a final result could be quite a long way off. The recount is almost finished, but legal battles remain over rejected absentee ballots. And Coleman says that some votes were counted twice. Gay Christian groups are reacting angrily to statements made by Pope Benedict. In his end-of-year address to senior Vatican staff, he said that saving humanity from homosexuality is just as important as saving the rainforest from destruction. The campaign group Human Rights Watch has urged Sri Lankan governments to allow aid agencies back into the north of the country, where the armed forces are fighting Tamil Tiger rebels. And finally, President-elect Barack Obama will take the oath of office using the same Bible upon which President Lincoln was sworn in at his first inauguration. He'll be the first president to do so since his first use back in 1861. And that's your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Around here, we call them low-hanging fruit. It's a holiday week, so we're thinking about holiday songs. What holiday songs are you thinking about?
Hi, this is Gail DeLong from Morristown, New Jersey. The holiday song in my mind is Snoopy's Christmas. And I actually don't mind that I can't get it out of my mind. I think it's a great song.
The Baron had Snoopy, Daddy sights. He reached for the trigger to pull it up tight.
Here's a holiday song, Lover. Are you a lover or are you a hater? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org.
Snoopy and the Red Baron. Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. A little news this morning, just crossing the wires. The final third quarter GDP number is a shrinkage of the U.S. economy by a half of a percentage point, and consumer spending shrank by 3.8% in the third quarter. That's the latest statistics. It's affecting the market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average in the futures predicts a flat to negative opening this morning on the last day of trading before Christmas, full day of trading before Christmas. So you know OPEC, all right, the oil-producing exporting countries, but GECF, how about that, Gas Exporting Countries Forum, and it's a name you might want to remember. But in the same month that OPEC has had trouble defending its price of oil, a production cut produced a drop in the price of oil as opposed to an increase, which is normally the case. Gas producers are getting together to discuss what they might do to perhaps consolidate the price of gas and enforce more of a sense of solidarity in the trading of gas, a very important fossil fuel that's traded all over the world and used all over the world. Joining us to discuss the implications of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, GECF, is Chris Weaver, who's the chief strategist at the Moscow-based Uralseb Capital firm. He joins us from London. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, led by Russia, and I want to talk about some of the other members who are in this forum in a moment, but the forum has suggested that it doesn't want to use OPEC as a model, that it's much more loosely interested in price consolidation. What do you think the agenda of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum is right now?
Well, I think right now the agenda is to create a group to coordinate in higher levels of investment into developing the gas product as a more significant part of global energy. You know, any thoughts of using it as a OPEC-style structure to control price or production, that's just not realistic right now because the gas market is far too small and it's too fragmented. Clearly, obviously, people will worry that eventually it might evolve into that, but we're a long way from there at this point. Certainly from Moscow's objective, they see an opportunity to, if you like, to push the gas as a major source of global energy in the future, because we all know, of course, the great concern about oil, about the future supply of oil and the future pricing of oil, and countries are looking at possibility of major investment into, say, a clean coal or nuclear power. So this is kind of a window of opportunity, particularly for Russia, to try and push greater level of investments into developing gas as a bigger part of global energy, and that, of course, then would improve Russia's position in the global energy market as well.
So it's more of a demand push kind of forum where you're trying to encourage demand as opposed to enforcing some sense of price based on constraints on supply. Gas is very expensive to produce. Is that likely to get better in the future, or is that stabilizing?
Well, that's one of the objectives of this forum, because one of the reasons why gas is expensive to produce is because there isn't a great deal of coordination in investment, and technologies generally are poor. So one of the objectives of putting this forum together, or at least to more formalizing the structure, is to create a forum where countries such as Russia and Qatar and other producers can pool their resources, as it were, and develop new technologies and bring down the cost of producing gas and make much more of it available in the form of LNG, more portable, more global. So that's certainly one of the objectives, is to bring the cost down, to increase the volume, essentially to make gas a viable alternative to nuclear and clean coal.
And indeed, that's been suggested here in the United States. T. Boone Pickens talks about using gas, liquefied natural gas, as a source of transportation fuel to replace gasoline. I'm wondering if deep in the agenda here on some level is political cover for Russia, which has used its gas production power as a bit of a weapon over Eastern and Western Europe. Do you think that by assembling this group of countries together, that Russia sort of buries its own political mission inside this more loosely organized forum of, hey, let's develop more gas?
Well, you know, it's when it comes to energy, there's always a gray line between economic objectives and political objectives when it comes to Russia, and there's no doubt about that. I mean, at this point, Russia is absolutely clearly stating that they want this forum to be, if you like, more of an investment club, a group of countries that can share the cost of developing technologies, etc., and they're absolutely steering away from any suggestion that this could be used as more of a, if you like, a political structure to try and influence supply and pricing. And absolutely, there's no way they could do that at this
sure.
point. The industry is just not developed enough. But, you know, it's obviously given the legacy of issues such as the dispute with Ukraine only a couple of years ago. And, of course, there's a possibility of a repeat of that dispute this at the end of this month as Russia is again fighting with Ukraine over unpaid bills. But, you know, so people are, consumer countries are certainly concerned about that. And one of the reasons why Russia is keen to have this forum in place is they're basically saying, look, you know, we can be a reliable energy partner group, we can develop more bigger volumes of it, but still, you know, I think that there's this legacy, as it were,
right.
of Russian action still there.
And it's wrong to compare the gas forum to OPEC, and that's great context. Chris Weefer is a chief strategist at the Moscow-based Uralsib capital firm. He joined us from London. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
And now, Femi Okeh has some headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, a big economic indicator just out, the GDP shrank in the third quarter. Housing and consumer sentiment numbers come out later this morning, and we'll hear more analysis from Martin Wolf of the Financial Times in just a few minutes. Another economic barometer is luxury sales. A data service called Spending Pulse says they fell by more than 30% during the first week of December. Luxury brands are responding by emphasizing quality, not quantity, in their adverts. Gay Christian groups are reacting angrily to statements made by Pope Benedict, and in his end-of-year address to senior Vatican staff, he said that saving humanity from homosexuality is just as important as saving the rainforest from destruction. Vladimir Luxuria, she was Italy's only transgender MP, has been talking about the Pope's statement.
To make this comparison between saving the rainforest, not the virgin forest, but the rainforest, and transgender people as destructive people, I think it's very hurting for a Catholic transgender.
And that was Italy's former transgender MP, Vladimir Luxuria. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us now is Martin Wolf, the chief economic commentator for the Financial Times. Martin, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
We've got a number of numbers to take a look at in the sort of waning moments of 2008. The third quarter GDP numbers for the United States are just out, and it shows a decline, not a big surprise, of 0.5% in the third quarter. Corporate profits falling 1.2%. Retail spending shrank by 3.8%, a different number. And perhaps the biggest number of the week, from my perspective, is Toyota's announcement that it will not make a profit for the first time since 1938. What do you see as a pattern here, or do we just see trends continuing, Martin?
Well, what actually surprises me is that the shrinkage of the U.S. economy was so modest in the third quarter. I know it won't feel like that, but it could well have been rather worse. And I'm sure the fourth quarter will be much, much worse. Over here in the UK, we've just had our third quarter announcement, and the economy actually shrank by 0.6%. And that's not annualized. That's the actual shrinkage in the quarter. And I will be surprised if the US didn't see something like that in the fourth quarter
wow.
or worse. The big picture is we're in a gathering world recession. We have been in recession since the beginning of the year, and it's going to continue and get, without any doubt, worse in 2009.
Well, let's go to our bookshelves, all right, if we studied economics in college. Looking at the Barack Obama administration, would you say they relied more on the monetarist textbooks in assembling what looks like their policy at this point, or something else?
I think they are modern Keynesians. It's important to remember that John Maynard Keynes, the founder of the Keynesian School, was himself a great monetary theorist and enormously influenced Milton Friedman. The essential idea here being that, and this is, I think, the two schools share, is that if you're faced with a depression, you have to deal with the demand problem. It's essentially a demand problem. It's a very complicated demand problem, and you use everything you can to stop the economy going to freefall. And in this case, it's very clear they are using everything, the most aggressive monetary policy imaginable, and what I expect to be the greatest fiscal boost in peacetime since the Second World War, that is.
I guess rather than saying monetarist, I should have said monetary restraint, since that is not what's going on now. There is the sort of supposition of printing of money, and the stimulus packages are all about stimulating demand. Is it possible that textbooks in the sort of waning moments of our time together here will be rewritten as we learn of the lag time of inflation, which is supposedly, and even Keynes predicted this, a consequence of this kind of extravagant demand-centered economic policy?
I think textbooks will not be rewritten. We will see exactly that sort of consequence in the end, and I think it's very difficult to get out of the sort of problem we're now in with some inflation at the end of it.
When do you think we'll begin to see that inflation? We certainly haven't yet.
Oh, certainly not for a very long time. If we look at Japan, they've been pursuing inflationary policy for a decade and a half. I don't think it will last quite that long. But these things are very long term. The demand implosion is very profound because the financial system is collapsing. And in this situation, I do not expect us to see inflation for quite a number of years.
All right, Martin Wolf, well, happy holidays to you.
Thank you.
Martin Wolf, Financial Times chief economic commentator, joined us from London, and we're grateful to him. The discussion was of the GDP numbers. A reminder, the U.S. GDP declined at an annual rate of 0.5% in the third quarter.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 23rd, and Femi Oke has joined us with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 13 minutes to the top of the hour. The Commerce Department has numbers out this morning for the GDP. It's the broadest measure of economic health. The GDP declined 0.5% last quarter, while corporate profits fell just over 1%. Now, so far this morning, we've had a coup and a denial of a coup from the West African country of Guinea. AP is now reporting seeing tanks and soldiers heading towards the presidential compound. A military group says that it seized power after the death yesterday of longtime President Lansana Conte, but Guinea's prime minister says his government has not been dissolved. The company that makes several G&J cocoa products is recalling them after samples tested positive for the chemical melamine. They're sold nationwide at Big Lots and Shopko stores, and there have been no reported illnesses so far. The Screen Actors Guild is delaying a vote to authorise a strike. It was supposed to take place this month, but now won't take place until the middle of January at the very earliest. Union leaders have been pushing for one, but some actors, including some A-list names, want to keep working. Now, let me just dip into my music beat to bring you some news about the Four Tops.
Let your heart be light.
The legendary Motown band will be picking up a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys in Los Angeles on the 7th of February. There also are some other career awards going out to the late Dean Martin, Gene Autry, Tom Paxton, and Brenda Lee. And that's a look at your news for now.
You don't even need that much of an excuse to play the Four Tops.
I could probably find one most days.
Lifetime
Achievement. You're welcome.
So holiday songs, what's the one song you can't get out of your head?
Hi, this is Chris calling from Dartmouth, and the Christmas song I can't get out of my head is Susie Snowflake, and I blame my wife for that because she plays it too much.
Here comes Susie Snowflake dressed in a snow
white gown, tap, tap, tapping at your window pane to tell you she's in town.
You can also blame Aunt Rosemary Clooney there, George's aunt, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
We're going to turn to the last days of the Bush administration. The administration has issued a controversial federal rule that allows health care workers to refuse to provide services that they find morally objectionable. Now, for decades, the law has allowed doctors and nurses to refuse to provide those objectionable procedures like abortion. But this new rule is much broader, applying to any service from abortion to birth control to artificial insemination. And it also apparently applies to any provider, from ambulance drivers to pharmacists to someone who sterilizes instruments in your doctor's office. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, the senior legal correspondent for Slate.com, for more. Welcome, Dahlia.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I was kind of surprised that they're adopting this rule basically at the 11th hour, particularly for an administration that has clearly been opposed to abortion and other similar procedures from the very beginning. Why now?
Well, this is actually one of a whole bunch of what are called midnight regulations. And this is not unheard of. Every administration tries to sort of jam in at the last minute a whole bunch of things that they couldn't get done congressionally or any other way. And there are a bunch of midnight regulations that are pretty troubling. I think this one is extremely troubling. And one of the things that's very interesting about this HHS conscience rule isn't just that it was jammed in at the last minute, but that they forgave themselves at every step of the way for missing all sorts of timing deadlines. In other words, they not only rushed this through at the last minute, but they missed their own deadlines in doing so. So it's sort of doubly egregious.
Because there's no doubt all kinds of procedural goals that they need to meet. But let's describe to us the provider conscience rule as it's been written and some of the concerns about whether or not it's even clear enough to enforce.
Well, I think you've nailed it right there. The problem is it's not terrifically clear. The rule up until now has been quite clear. There's been, as you said, federal protection for doctors and nurses. They couldn't be forced to participate in an abortion. That's been on the books for decades. What this one does, as you said, is broaden that out so expansively that we're not even completely clear on who it applies to. Moreover, we're not clear on what sorts of services it applies to. One of the things that's particularly troubling is not just the vagueness of the language, but it looks to include even basic medical information, such that a doctor who objects to abortion need not tell a patient, for instance, that he's seen something on her scan that might suggest that there's a problem with the fetus. So it's not simply services. It crosses the line into the ability to decline to provide important medical information that could help women make good choices.
But Dahlia, do these regulations explicitly shield doctors from legal challenges? I mean, there's no way a regulation can actually do something like that.
What it says is that federal funding will be cut from any medical institution or hospital that doesn't provide these protections. So it's a pretty attenuated way of getting, you're quite right, it's a pretty way attenuated way of providing protection to the physicians. But what it essentially does is threaten to cut funding if hospitals don't enforce the regulations as vague as they are that are on the books now.
And it's also possible, though, that it will conflict with any given state law.
Well, that's true. And in fact, the Attorney General in Connecticut is already saying he's going to bring a lawsuit challenging it. Many, many states have conscience laws. This is not simply a federal rule that they're overriding. What they're doing is tinkering with the laws on the books in different states. And each state has arrived at a very different, very nuanced compromise on this question. So Connecticut is saying not only is this a sort of federalism question, a states' rights question, where you have run roughshod through an agreement that we have made as a state with our physicians and nurses, but that you've also really, obliterated a very, very carefully worked out compromise that was very clear and was understood by everybody, and replaced it with this rule that in effect seems to give the right of a veto to any medical provider, as you said, including an ambulance driver, a pharmacist, or someone who sterilizes needles.
I just find this whole thing, Dahlia, to be another constitutional insult on the way out on the part of the Bush administration. And, you know, the Clinton administration was just as guilty of it. Why these legal regulatory manipulations at the end? Can't the Obama administration simply reverse them on its first day of office?
Well, it can't do it on the first day. What it has to do, unfortunately, is get its own HHS to put forth new regulations, and that involves a lengthy comments period, a lengthy public comments period. So it could take months. Now, the shorter way to reverse this will be to have Congress do it legislatively, and there's already several senators who've said that's going to be their priority come January. But the fact is, any way you do this, it's kind of a mess. And underlying this legal question you're asking about, how do we undo this, it also relaunches this very, very ugly abortion debate that I thought we managed to sort of elide in this last election. I thought Obama did a nice job of turning down the temperature on this, of trying to be moderate and trying to say, you know, let's agree to disagree, let's try to be principled. He took a stand that was quite dramatic, saying, you know, he opposes abortion, he's going to try to decrease unwanted pregnancy. All that seemed very thoughtful and careful, and this seems to really have escalated something that we were doing a good job of talking through in a more sensible way.
Well, yet another thing to add to his very long list of things that President-elect Barack Obama is going to have to address immediately when he gets into office. But Dahlia, before you go, of course, we got to ask you, it's the holiday season. Is there a song you love or despise because you just can't get it out of your head?
Well, I'll tell you something. I just did a piece last week on the rules for little Jewish kids and Christmas TV shows because I grew up for some reason only allowed to watch the Charlie Brown special. I watched Frosty for the first time last week and have not been able to get that song out of my head for a week.
Frosty the Snowman.
Dahlia Lithwick, thank you. Dahlia is a senior legal correspondent for Slate.com and someone with Frosty the Snowman stuck in her brain.
And we learned that Charlie Brown is kosher. I did not know that. So what about holiday songs in your brain?
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And I have had no Christmas song stuck in my head, remarkably. But I have had the song Call Me by the 80s group Blondie stuck in my head for about a week. So in honor of Blondie herself, have a Debbie Harry Christmas. And the upside is that it's certainly a sexy Christmas.
Among other things that Blondie proved, anyone can make a holiday album. Call us with your earworm at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here's this hour's takeaway.
This will be something that people who want to find conspiracies and want to find reasons to go after Obama can dig into forever.
Politico's Ben Smith talking about Obama's report later today about White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel and any wrongdoing, not in contacts with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. We're always on. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
For an updated depression, an updated wardrobe.
My coat of many colors that my mama made for me. Made only from rags, but I wore it so proudly.
This time one color, but it's many coats that are needed. Designing for the homeless, planning for an economic downturn. When hand-me-downs are not enough. Economic fashion statements on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 23rd. And yes, we do have an interesting story about a coat designed for the homeless. And it has something to do with newspapers, but we're going to explain that.
Yes, good morning, Adora. Newspapers, you stuff them in your coat, and it's actually a great insulator.
It's a great insulator, indeed it is. Also today, we're going to be talking about shoplifting. It's on the rise, and it certainly is an unusual economic indicator. Also, some good news from Africa. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Key numbers, just out this morning show the American economy is suffering. The GDP shrunk a half a percentage point annualized in the third quarter. There could be more bad news later this morning. Consumer sentiment and home sales numbers will be out. From east to west, much of the country is a mess of wind, snow, and ice, and holiday air travel is going to be tough. In the Midwest, Chicago's skies are threatened by snow and wind, and with wind chill that could hit negative 20, city emergency officials are worried about the homeless.
The Department of Human Services has been going out on the street providing well-being checks, and transportation is available to one of our warming centers.
Chicago emergency worker Jennifer Martinez, the bitter cold and snow hasn't spared the Northeast. Maine is seeing one of the worst snowstorms on record, and major cities are feeling frigid temperatures.
The Northwest is also suffering. An unusual snowstorm in Seattle has travelers locked down. Meteorologist Chris Burke doesn't see that snow going anywhere yet.
There's a pretty decent chance we're going to have a white Christmas in that the snow will not have completely melted by then.
You may not be headed to any of these snowy cities, but don't forget that airspace shutdowns in major hubs have a ripple effect on airports around the country from LAX to Atlanta and beyond. There's new information in the investigation into a fiery Denver plane crash. Here's National Transportation Safety Board member Robert Sumalt on what they heard on the jet's black box.
41 seconds after brake release, there became a bumping and rattling that started, and that continued through the end of the recording.
After that, the crew aborted takeoff. The plane skidded off the runway and caught fire, injuring dozens.
Another report of the political variety later today. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Today, President-elect Barack Obama's transition team is set to release a report on its contacts with the embattled governor's office. The Dow dropped just shy of 1% yesterday. It begins trading at 85.19. Today is the last full day of trading on Wall Street. The S&P begins at 8.71. Holiday songs in your brain. Derek is the winner. No more calls. The ultimate girl band, Shonen Knife, with their song Space Christmas. Tell us yours at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Some would say En Vogue is the ultimate girl band. Or the Bangles.
Spice Girls.
Spice Girls.
The
yeah.
Supremes.
Well, they're beyond that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Perhaps the real bad news will come in the fourth quarter of 2008, but we have the GDP number for the third quarter, and it shows an annual shrinkage of the U.S. economy at a rate of 0.5%. It's expected that that will get worse in the fourth quarter, but we won't know for another 3 months or so. Also, retail sales shrinking 3.8%, just two of the numbers that are out today. Another one in about an hour is the National Association of Realtors, which is going to release the existing and new home sales figures for the month of November. There have been records all this fall, and now that we're into winter, is it going to be another dismal month for what was once the steadiest retail market on the planet here in the United States? Joining us on the case is Carl Case, who's the co-producer of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. He's a professor of economics at Wellesley College, and he joins us from his home in Massachusetts. Carl, hey, can I call you Chip?
You may.
All right. First of all, tell me about this index. What is it precisely that you are measuring, and how do you do it? And what do you expect in the latest numbers?
Well, we measure prices. We get all the transactions that occur, both auction sales from foreclosures as well as existing sales in the traditional buyer-seller searching process. We get all the sales, and then we look up when those same properties changed hands last. So we produce what's called a repeat sales index. that measures the appreciation or depreciation that takes place in the value of houses.
So it's kind of a raw number, but then averaged. I'm wondering what the component of foreclosures is in the latest index, and has that been rising?
Well, if you look at October, there were 418,000 existing sales, unseasonally adjusted. We've been running at about 5 million. That's the number that's going to come out today. Of those, about 20%, about 85,000 in October. So November, we'll see. We know that the auctions are up about 2,000, not a huge number, 2,500, between October and November. Then the auction numbers are out. Today, we get the existing numbers. And my bet is they're still bouncing around about 5 million, which is a bigger number, but not as important a number as the new home sales figure, which comes out today as well.
And what do you expect on that?
Well, I expect that'll be down. That's the new home sales are important because each one represents about $200,000 or $300,000 in economic activity directly. When you buy or sell an existing home, there's nobody producing it, so it's just a trade. But in the new home sales, they're down to 433,000. That's a very low number, and it's been falling very rapid, down 40% year over year. Where for the last year, existing home sales have been about the same, about 5 million.
Well, you make a great case for the importance of this number because you've got a lead. Indicator, if you're looking at new home sales, you've got an indication of the value of the market in the existing home sales, and then you've also got the depth of the recession in looking at the component of this that is actually foreclosures and auction sales. If you're thinking there's no place like home for the holidays this Christmas, are we looking forward to falling off the cliff in January, or are things starting to stabilize?
Well, you call me a blind optimist. I think there's likely to be some positive news. All the consensus is that both existing home sales and new home sales will be down, and I'm not saying they're not, but I think there's a chance they might sneak upward a little bit. I think if you look at the foreclosure sales, there's a larger number of them in the October in the October data, but I think in general they're starting to slow down and clear out. So that's the key, because that's what's driving price down. If you look at the places where the foreclosure sales are, Florida, California, Nevada, it's a third to a half the country is being driven by a few states.
Wow.
Where most of the auction sales are. And those have got a problem. It's going to take a while to work out. But the rest of the country is not doing bad. You look at Boston, we're down about 12% year over year in pricing. Actually, 12% since the peak, and that's hardly hemorrhaging for price. And we've been doing it for over 3 years now.
Chip, so I want to ask you a really quick question before we go.
Sure.
What's the bigger driver here, availability of credit or home prices dropping?
Oh, they're both important.
They're both important.
So unfortunately, is employment.
Yeah.
Because employment, if you look at the things that really drive the market, it's prices and employment, So you pay your money, you take your chances.
There
you
go.
If you're an optimist, you look for the sunshine.
Well, Carl Case, our optimist, Chip Case, co-producer of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, which comes out later today. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
He's an economics professor at Wellesley College, where he joined us. Adora?
Now to a different kind of economic indicator. Today, the New York Times reports shoplifters are getting away with $35 million worth of goods every day. And the numbers are skyrocketing. And for more, we turn to reporter Ian Urbina, who joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Ian.
Thanks so much.
So you came across this story. Very quickly, describe the story that led you to this new story, which is reverse shoplifters. Can you explain that?
Sure. So a year ago, we did a story on reverse shoplifting. It's also called shop dropping. And it's this strange sort of subculture of mostly artists who create, action figures and their own T-shirts, usually with a political message on them. So a action figure with a shirt that says Save Darfur or the like, and they make these items very convincingly, so they look like normal store-bought items, and they then sneak into stores and put them on the shelves with hopes that people will buy them and take home the message. So we ran a story last holiday season about that phenomena, and in talking with those people this year, just checking in with them, they mentioned that shop dropping overall seemed to be really increasing. And that's what caused me to start digging into regular shop drop.
Because then you discovered that there's also a lot more goods going out the door. Is it triggered by the economic downturn, or are criminal rings seeing an opportunity to sell things more cheaply, or basically are they the same?
I think it's both, yeah. I think that there are two ends of the spectrum. I think that the rings are seeing more of an opportunity because there's more of a market. People are trying to find things cheaper. The internet has opened up a huge area for these rings, so they don't have to hawk them at pawn shops and garage sales. But on the other end of the spectrum, you have a lot more, at least the security experts I was talking to, a lot more average folk who are making bad decisions over very small items that they come up, you know, short in trying to buy, and so they just decide to pocket them instead.
It's interesting because you report that police departments across the country say shoplifting arrests are up between 10 and 20% compared to last year. What are the stores doing?
Well, a range of things. There's this whole sub-industry, and it's one of the industries that's benefited from this trend, that is largely pushing to technological methods, ranging from, you know, the we talk about a company, Leads Online, that helps stores and malls comb eBay and Craigslist and these sorts of sites to make sure that their goods aren't ending up there. So the company is doing that, but there are also companies that are sending, that are selling, you know, smaller and more savvy in some ways, protective devices, you know, to attach to items of clothing that can as easily be taken off or be foiled by crafty shoplifters. And then, you know, but what stores aren't doing, I mean, the other interesting part of the story is that stores are also feeling the crunch. And so on the one hand, they don't want to scare away customers, so they're becoming a little bit more reluctant to target the shoplifters for fear that they could target the wrong person and cause a scene and run out good business. So that's one thing that stores are doing that's heading the opposite way and maybe increasing their vulnerability. But they're also tending to have to cut staff,
right,
which is further increasing their vulnerability.
As are the police, as you report. They're freezing hiring, and with fewer police officers, shoplifting becomes less of a priority.
Exactly, and police are also being told to prioritize. So if they get two different types of calls, you know, shoplifting calls should be lowest on the totem pole. So even with the existing but shrinked forces, the shoplifting calls are getting less attention.
It's fascinating how you talk about the internet has essentially encouraged an explosion in the kinds of scams that these rings can set up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always somewhat amazed at the craftiness of the dark side, and that's another name for the internet. And you know, it's just
is
like,
that your beat, Ian? The dark side, the dark side reporter for the.
I wish it were. We'd be breaking news every day.
And we could, and that's actually a segment for another day, but certainly a component of this story. Today, we just want to ask you quickly, Ian. It's the holidays. You got a song you love or you hate?
Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
You love that or you hate that?
Yeah, I despise it.
Thanks very much, Ian. Ian Urbina is a New York Times correspondent. He was telling us about his reporting on shoplifting and skyrocketing numbers.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's a holiday week, which means lots of holiday songs. Are there some songs you can't get out of your head, or are there some songs you just love hearing over and over again?
Hi, it's Paul. My favorite song has become All I Want for Christmas Is You, because it takes the onus off gifts. It takes the onus off whether it snows or not, where we're located. It just kind of makes it personal. Have a happy holidays.
I love this song. It's my favorite holiday song. I love this song. Thank you, George. Happy holidays to you, too. We want to hear about what your favorite song is, or the one that just, like, grates your nerves. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Cheese for the holidays here on The Takeaway. So in a story that has yet another frustrating set of implications for Americans in the post-9/11 era, and also for lawyers and individuals attempting to seek justice in this puzzling era, jurors have found five Muslim immigrants guilty of conspiring to kill U.S. soldiers at the Fort Dix Army Base in New Jersey, but they acquitted the five of attempted murder. Prosecutors painted the verdict as a victory over homegrown terrorism, while defense attorneys argued that the government relied on a paid informant who they characterized as more of a con man to get their case. George Anastasia is a reporter from the Philadelphia Inquirer who is on this story. He joins us from Pittman, New Jersey. George, thanks for being with us.
Sure. How are you?
You know, again, let me just begin with the sort of citizen of America question. How am I to feel about the fact that these five immigrants are now found guilty and can theoretically face life in prison over these charges and this conviction?
Well, I think what this case is about on one level is the emotional reaction to terrorism. And if you're caught up in a terrorism case, it's going to be a lot more difficult to defend yourself. I mean, that's part of what happened here. There's no doubt there was evidence. In fact, most of the evidence in the case was not disputed. The question throughout the case was, what was the intent? Yeah, they said this. Yeah, they did that. But what did they, you know, what was the purpose behind it? And that's where we are. And the split decision kind of, to me, indicates the jury at least was aware and conscious of that and making an effort to parse the charges. But the bottom line is, these five are still looking at potential life in prison because they were convicted of conspiracy here.
I want to talk about the defense's charges against the prosecution in a moment, but is it fair to say that this is a case where individuals who act badly versus individuals who act badly but are intending to carry things out is really the ambiguity, that there's a lot of people that do things that are offensive, but that doesn't necessarily constitute a crime?
I think what you've got to put the context of terrorism to talk about what you intend to do in the context of post 9/11 America and jihad and radical Islam. Those kind of things are I think were the factors that played in this case, separate and apart from the evidence and the testimony. It was that whole kind of aura of terrorism that kind of hangs over the country right now.
All right, well, let's listen to Rocco Ciparoni, who's the defense attorney, talking about the role of the informants in this case, which, as we've said, the defense said was key, that if there had not been these informants, there would not have been this plot. But here's Attorney Ciparoni.
My personal opinion is that there would not have been a plan or advancement of these alleged objectives without these two informants being involved.
Now, is it possible that the defense has it wrong? Well, I mean, certainly the jury thinks that the defense had it wrong, but this is a case of investigators acting preemptively, attempting to get out in front of terrorists regardless of their competence.
I mean, yeah, that's the whole strategy here, preventive arrest. When do you move in and break up an alleged plot? Or do you wait until they've got the guns in the car and they're driving to Fort Dix? I mean, that's the fundamental question in all of this. And the jury obviously agreed with the prosecution that there was a plot. And the fact that they found them not guilty of attempted murder, I think, indicates they believe they hadn't taken any substantive step to put that plot in motion. But it doesn't – I mean, that's, I guess, both the benefit and the negative of a conspiracy charge. I mean, defense attorneys hate a conspiracy charge because it's you know, it's a big umbrella. But prosecutors love a conspiracy charge because a lot of separate
acts. It's a big umbrella.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And George,
there you go.
When you came here to report to us last time, you said one of the questions would be whether or not there was a sense the jury was looking at these defendants as guilty and therefore was looking for evidence to show their innocence as opposed to what the basic tenet of criminal law in our country is, which is you're innocent until proven guilty. Having watched this trial now, what do you think the jury started out with as they listened to this testimony with all of these very explosive buzzwords as you laid them out?
Well, I think the fact that this jury took 6 days to reach this verdict indicates to me that they were serious about what they were doing and they took their job seriously, and I don't think it was a slam dunk. I would love to talk to some of the jurors. So far, they've indicated they don't want to speak to us. So, you know, I think in that sense, the system worked, but the emotionalism that comes into play had a lot to do with this. The other factor, and this may come up on appeal, is the judge allowed the prosecution to enter videotapes that two of the defendants had downloaded onto their laptops that were depictions of beheadings in Iraq, suicide missions in Iraq, radical Islamic speeches. The defense argued none of that had anything to do with the plot to attack Fort Dix. The prosecution argued that it went to the mindset of the defendants. And I think that had to create an emotional aspect to the jury. And the other thing that factored in, and don't lose sight of this, is Mumbai happened about a week and a half before deliberations began.
That's interesting.
And one of the last prosecution witnesses, the rebuttal witness, was an FBI terrorism expert who got up on the stand and said, it doesn't take a lot for five or six people to launch an attack. If you've had the weapons, you know, you can do it. And then he cited Mumbai.
Wow.
And I think that's something else. I mean, the jury's not in a vacuum. They're not supposed to be reading about the Fort Dix trial as it unfolds. But everything else, every other event that happens, they're exposed to that.
Well, in a post 9/11 era, there's no such thing as a vacuum post 9/11. Yeah. It's very interesting. It seems like the takeaway is that at the very least, the juror permits this kind of preemptive behavior on the part of prosecutors to get out in front of the intent of even incompetent terrorists. George, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
George Anastasia is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer on that Fort Dix case. And Femi Oke has some quick headlines.
Just looking at the futures, the markets open in a couple of minutes' time. Dow futures up just a little bit, 10 points. S&P up around about 4 points. It's the last full day of trading before Christmas, and the latest GDP numbers came out an hour ago. The economy shrank in the summer by an annual rate of 0.5 percentage point. Expecting some more economic news later this morning, consumer sentiment and home sales are due out next hour. And that's a look at your news very quickly. I'll be back in 10 minutes.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In this holiday spirit, we're looking for holiday songs that you can't get out of your mind.
Hi, John. Hi, Adora. This is David from Putnam, Connecticut. I love the holidays, but the one song I cannot stand is Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. I kind of liken it to having to sit and watch Teletubbies for 48 straight hours. Yuck.
Grandma got run over.
What's the guy's problem? I mean, it's a beautiful song, heartfelt, really. I mean, says Christmas to me.
It's
like Teletubbies.
Violent.
877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
We're going to turn to something called the 15 Below Jacket. And it's not a new designer fad. It's really the brainchild of a Canadian designer designed to help keep people warm in the winter. Steve Michelin came up with the idea to help the homeless. He's the creative director for the ad agency Taxi, and he's donating 3,000 of these jackets to the homeless this season. He joins us from Toronto. Good morning and welcome, Steve.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Okay, let's start with how you tested this jacket. You spent some time in a meat locker. How long and what was that like?
Well, it was boring. 8 hours sitting in a meat locker and standing there watching guys work because they store meat there. But the first 4 hours was at about 20 below zero, and then the last hour was at 40 below zero in the blast freezer. I was so bored I had to find something new to do. So that was a bit of an insight into how it must be to be a homeless guy on the street at night. Boring.
Did your jacket keep you warm?
Yeah, it did. And the irony of this is there was a paramedic there who took my vital signs every 45 minutes, starting just before I went into the locker and all the way through. And by the end of it, he went into the blast freezer. He got frostbite, but my signs stayed stable for the whole 8 hours.
Okay, now let's go to the beginning. How did you come up with this idea, and then describe the jacket?
Well, the idea was born out of a challenge that came from our chairman, Paul Lavoie. We were celebrating 15 years in business, and he wanted an idea that would give back to the community. I was walking home from a Raptors game one night with my son, and we had courtside seats that were given to us for free. They're hundreds of dollars, and we were laughing about that. And halfway home, we see a homeless guy, and he stops to give the guy money. And I say, come on, it's cold. Let's keep going. And he says to me, why do you sometimes give money, sometimes don't? Why don't you just help this guy out? And he got me thinking, and that was where the idea started.
So how did you design? Where do you begin with something like this?
Well, to be honest, there was a bit of irony in the whole thing, creating a jacket that could be insulated with newspapers. And, of course, we do advertising, and I thought, wouldn't it be funny if our ads were the insulation? That way they'd work twice as hard. And essentially that was kind of the what made it interesting for us. And then,
were you surprised to find out that newspaper is one of the best kinds of insulation? It almost sounds counterintuitive. It's just paper.
It is, but when it's reduced in size, it becomes cellulose, and it becomes something very, very dense. And the smaller it gets, the denser it gets with small air pockets to act as an insulator. It's really easy to work with, obviously, but the number of things that we discovered along the way, including that, were kind of eerie. For example, in Canada, on November 15th to April 15th, the government issues cold weather alerts when the temperature drops to 15 below zero. And here we are celebrating our 15th anniversary. And in the end, coincidentally, the coat ended up with 15 pockets. And that was a total coincidence because we eliminated one of the pockets in the hood at the very during the last prototype. Kind of weird.
What is the danger here of creating a jacket that is functionally fabulous and definitely goes to the issue of surviving in cold weather in places like Toronto, but becomes more like the, you know, prison garb where it immediately identifies you as a homeless person and therefore would be unattractive as a result?
Well, it's pretty discreet. It's just a black jacket that could look like a windbreaker and with virtually no branding on it. So unlike a fluorescent prison guard that I think says prison on the back, it's pretty discreet, and I don't think would be something that people would say, hey, wait a minute, that guy must be homeless because look at his jacket. You wouldn't really notice it in that way.
Well, you wouldn't, but what do the homeless say?
Well, you know what? I would have to ask them that question.
As a designer, that's probably something you ought to do, though, right?
Yeah, well, you know, we did do a lot of research on this project. We talked to different social agencies about what was something that homeless people could use. And there was various things, socks, hats, a coat. And I guess, you know, to be honest, to make a coat available, it has to be made in one design. So I guess that's the price you pay.
So describe the jacket. You say it's sort of like a windbreaker.
Yeah, it's a 365 days a year jacket. It's waterproof, and it's got grommets under the armpits for breathability. It's got two liners, 15 pockets. There's one on the back that actually reverses out and becomes a backpack. So during the summer months, you can actually carry the jacket on your back. It has straps. It's got a beard guard on the zipper. The zippers are all waterproof. There's about six pull tabs to tighten it up for air penetration, and pockets inside the hoods, as well as the sleeves and the back and the front and pretty well everywhere.
And it basically folds up. I've seen one. It folds up very small, so you can almost stick it in your pocket.
Not quite in your pocket, but you can. It does fold up to a small pillow size.
Okay, Steve Mikkelin, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, my pleasure. Hope it's warmer down there than it is up here.
Unfortunately, not so much, Steve. Steve is from an ad agency. It's called Taxi, and he's one of the designers of the 15 Below jacket. And now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the headlines.
Good morning. The Dow is up 36 points. And let's take a look at some of the other stories making headlines this morning. Federal investigators will continue going through the wreckage of a Continental Airlines plane in Denver. The plane went off the runway and caught on fire while trying to take off on Saturday. Rattling and bumping can be heard on the flight's black box recording just before the accident. Fierce winter weather is hitting much of the country. It's caused travel problems and power outages. Stranded Greyhound passengers in Seattle are in homeless shelters now because the bus company says it's too dangerous for bus travel. Gay Christian groups are denouncing statements made yesterday by Pope Benedict. He said that homosexual or transsexual behaviour could lead to self-destruction of the human race. A massive water main break is causing problems in Bethesda, Maryland. Helicopters are working to rescue people whose cars have been stranded in 4 feet of water. At least a dozen have been rescued so far. No injuries reported yet. And the Screen Actors Guild is delaying a vote to authorise a strike. Many top A-lister actors think it's not the right time to vote for a strike. That's a look at some of the news making headlines this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
I'll be tying on my flying shoes, flying shoes.
So, folks, if you had hoped to get yourself a pair of Model 271 Baydon shoes in time for Christmas, it looks like you may be out of luck. The Baydon shoes that were reportedly hurled by Muntadir al-Zaidi at President Bush in Baghdad 2 weeks ago are made in Turkey. On the line is Baydon export agent Omar Bogatikin in Istanbul. Now, how many orders do you normally have for the Model 271 right now?
Lots of orders. It's about 300,000.
Three hundred thousand.
Yeah, only in two weeks.
In 2 weeks, what do you normally sell of Model 271 in a year?
Normally, it's about 20,000.
20,000. So you're now up to 300,000. Now, what is it about the shoe design that makes it so good for hurling at world leaders, Omar? What is it? Is it in the sole? Is it in the toe? What is it?
Well, it's a little bit big shoe, and the sole is polyurethane, and the top of it is leather shoe. It's one pair is about 600 grams.
600 grams. So it's a heavy shoe, which is really good for throwing. Now, are you thinking of changing the name from Model 271, possibly?
Yeah, we have changed it. It's now we call it Bye Bye Bush Shoe.
The Bye Bye Bush Shoe.
Yeah. Formerly it was 271, and now we changed it. And lots of people are asking for us for Bush Shoe.
Now, is it possible that naming a shoe Bye-Bye Bush and encouraging people to hurl it at an American president is disrespectful in some way and could contribute to instability in the world?
Yeah.
Right, but that's not a problem because, you know, shoes make the world go round, right?
Yeah, it does.
Well, Omar, what's next? I mean, you got how many products there at the Baydon Shoe Company in Istanbul?
Now, we have just started some orders. We have just received some orders from Iraqi clients, and we are preparing them. And at the end of this week, we will send about 15,000 taxpayers to Iraq.
To Iraq?
Start working.
Right.
Yeah.
Any chance that other shoes at your factory could be sort of redesigned for different purposes? Maybe bye-bye Putin?
Not yet. We hope this.
Thanks. Omar Bogatikin, who's the export agent for Beydan Shoe Company. He joined us from Istanbul. A few more details here. The normally $40 shoes may be a bit pricier in the post-TOS era. The factory has hired 100 people to deal with the orders. And Serkan Turk, Beydan's general manager, told a Western reporter just last week, and this is a direct quote, "Bush server some good purpose to the economy before he left." Well, there you go. A legacy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 23rd, and Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. A big economic indicator came out this morning. The GDP shrank in the third quarter. Housing and consumer sentiment numbers come out later this morning. The Obama transition team is set to release a report today detailing its interactions with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. They said that they've held off on releasing it at the request of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Blagojevich is accused of trying to sell the president-elect's vacant Senate seat. A street in Bethesda, Maryland, called River Road.
Bethesda.
Do you know, I was concentrating so hard on saying Maryland rather than Maryland that I got the other word wrong.
Oh, someday. Okay. Someday right. You'll get a visa.
Anyway, someday. It's called River Road. Quiet, please. And it has become true to its name today. You're messing up my pun. A water main break there has stranded cars in about 4 feet of water, and helicopters are lowering baskets to rescue people. No injuries have been reported. Interesting morning for the West African state of Guinea. The army said it had taken over and dissolved the government. But so far, no troops have appeared on the streets of the capital. We have seen some news of that beginning to change. And the prime minister said that there so far has been no coup. So that is a rather confusing situation right now. President Lassana Conte, who ruled Guinea for 24 years, died yesterday. Now, a few weeks ago, we found out about the musicians and artists nominated for Grammy Awards for their work in the past year. And this week we're getting news of the Grammys that go to artists celebrating a whole lifetime of their work. And one posthumous award goes to rap packer Dean Martin.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I gotta go
but
away.
Baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop
so
in.
Very
So Dean Martin's Lifetime Achievement Award will be presented at the Grammys on February the 7th, 2009. Other artists also being honoured, Gene Autry, the Blind Boys of Alabama, Four Tops, Hank Jones, Brenda Lee and Tom Paxton. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. It is cold outside.
So,
more holiday songs. They're everywhere. In the drugstore, in the elevator. You can't get away from them. What's the one that you can't get out of your head, or maybe the version?
My name's Tony. I'm a band director in Brooklyn, New York. And I have a plethora of holiday tunes in my head. The only problem is they're all really bad, watered-down arrangements.
He's big and loose, he's kicking in twice.
Think before you make a holiday album. That's Bruce Springsteen. Of course, tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
On to more serious topics. Africa. There's plenty of bad news out of Africa. We report on it regularly, from the conflict in Congo to the cholera outbreaks in Zimbabwe. But there is some good news. Charles Stith is the former U.S. ambassador to Tanzania, and he is an editor of the book For Such a Time as This, African Leadership Challenges. It's a new book. He says that Africa does have a lot of good things happening, and he joins us now from Boston. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you.
So good news. Good news. Give it to us.
Well, the continent, I think, is on a real growth trajectory at this point. We track 16 countries on the continent, and they are all serious about democratization. They're serious about reforming their economies along free market lines. And though it's only 16 countries out of the 53 in the continent, 48 in the sub-Saharan Africa, and that's a little bit more than a third of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, overall, it's about two-thirds of the population of the continent. It has about 650 million people. So the good news is that the vast majority of folks on the African continent wake up every morning in a country where they can participate in deciding who runs the country. They don't have the Guinea problem that you referenced earlier in the news report. And they live in countries where the leadership is really trying to reform the economies in a way that they can maximize their opportunities and improve the quality of life for them and their families.
Among those 16, you would include Mali, South Africa, Ghana, Cape Verde, Mauritius. Profile one of them for us. What do they have in common, and what makes this possible given so much conflict in the past, the colonial rule in the past, and in modern history? All of those things, what has helped these countries, in your mind, grow?
Well, let me start with the last question first, and that is the kind of historical question that gives some context to what's happening now. At the point of the end of colonialism, most countries on the continent had very little, if any, infrastructure at all. I'll never forget when I was talking to the former president of Mozambique, Joaquim Chissano, during his last term, and I asked him what was the colonial experience under the Portuguese, what was that like? And he said to me, and I'll never forget it, that if they had had apartheid in Mozambique, it would have been a step up from what they experienced under colonialism at the hands of the Portuguese. So it is really building physical infrastructure, a kind of social infrastructure. Many of these countries, there were no African lawyers, doctors, or teachers, very few in the way of schools. All of that had to be built up. Then there was also the Cold War, which was a very hot war in Africa. At one point, there were some 50 conflicts going on. And as is the case in any war, you can't develop in the midst of destruction. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you had the impact of apartheid, which from the U.S. perspective, we tended to focus only on its impact on the native South Africans. But the reality is that the South African government did a lot to destabilize the entire continent. They went as far north as Tanzania in trying to depose the late Julius Nyerere, one of the most well-respected figures on the continent and in the world. Now that all of that's behind the continent, it's really poised and positioned to move in some rather dramatic ways.
Yet, Ambassador, if you look at the Zimbabwe situation, you have a political stalemate that evolves into a deterioration of infrastructure and what many international observers are now viewing as possibly a failed state. And you already have Congo as an example of a state that goes that direction, Somalia to a certain extent. That is sort of the political shadow, I think, that haunts the post-colonial African narrative.
Well, I think it's simply because that's the stuff we focus on. I mean, it really is, at the end of the day, the tail wagging the dog, because the numbers speak for themselves. You've got 16 countries with 650 million people out of 800 million. So the vast majority of people are in countries that are on track. And what you're seeing...
Is it really just a majority game? I mean, you just play a sort of a... If a majority is going in the right direction, that means the trends on the continent are acceptable?
Well, I'd certainly say it's better than the converse, that if we had the majority of people living in situations that were as unstable as what we see in Guinea and in Zimbabwe and Congo, the continent would be in a lot worse shape. But the good news is that the numbers of states that are coming online in terms of issues of governance and the economy is increasing. When we started the center in 2001, there were 13 countries. You know, today there's 16 countries. There's a lot of pressure.
You're talking about the center at Boston University,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the African Presidential Archives and Research Center. Thank you, Adoria. You've got... The trend is going in the right direction. Even the situation in Zimbabwe, recently elected president Khama in Botswana has come out in strong opposition to Mugabe. And my sense is that I think leaders in the region will begin to turn up the pressure on him. I think one of the other things that's promising is the introduction of new technologies on the continent, number one of which are cell phones.
And that has certainly exploded, Ambassador, in the last couple of years. But we're going to have to leave it there. We appreciate your perspective, and you certainly give us a few things to think about this morning about Africa. Charles Stith, former ambassador to Tanzania, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
The ambassador is also the editor of For Such a Time as This, African Leadership Challenges.
So we've got a number of economic indicators this morning. Here for this hour is your takeaway.
I'm always somewhat amazed at the craftiness of the dark side, and that's another name for the Internet.
That's Ian Urbina, New York Times correspondent, talking about a growth in first-time shoplifters, both on the Internet and in stores this retail season. We're always on. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or at iTunes.
And we want to know your favorite holiday song, 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Adoree Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.